Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Presidents since Dwight D. Eisenhower have presided over the National Prayer Breakfast. Though not an official government event, its attendees include the powerful politicians from the U.S. and around the world. The group behind the breakfast, known as the Family, is a powerful, secretive organization. Author Jeff Charlotte offers an inside account of an organization rarely in the news, but whose members include some of the most powerful people in the country. His new book is titled The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. We do invite your questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to you, Jeff. Welcome.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for having me.
I gather that the family has some other names.
Yeah, they're also known as the Fellowship or the Prayer Breakfast Folks. Over history, they've been known as International Christian Leadership, National Christian Leadership. One leader of the organization described this process of renaming themselves as a method of preventing institutionalization. They don't want to be known. They don't want publicity. And so they are constantly opening and closing nonprofit organizations and different, very literally, front groups that allow them to operate. But the most enduring name for the last 30 years has been the family as an umbrella for all the aspects of it.
How and why did you get involved?
Well, as a journalist, I write mainly about religion. And while I was researching my first book about unusual religious communities around the United States, a friend of mine asked me if I would meet with her brother, who had recently become involved with a family, because she was concerned that he had joined a cult. She herself is a conservative Christian, but it was so different than anything she'd ever heard of. Her brother had left a good career in finance and left his fiance to go and live with this group of young men being groomed for leadership in the family in Arlington, Virginia. And when I met with him, I'd known him for years. He was very insistent that I could only understand this by seeing it for myself. And then if I saw it for myself, I would be persuaded. Persuaded of this strange theology they have that they sometimes paraphrase as Jesus plus nothing. And when they say plus nothing, they mean no history, no scripture, no other influences. Every decision should be filtered through their idea of Jesus plus nothing. Not just, you know, grand moral issues, but very ordinary day-to-day things. What this amounts to in practice is a kind of elite fundamentalism. It's fundamentalism, but not like we think of it on televangelists, TV preachers, that kind of thing. It's this very almost esoteric fundamentalism.
In fact, they shy away from the connection with televangelists. Is that correct?
They do. They do. One of my arguments in the book is that when we go back and we look at the history of American religion in the 20th century, we really need to look at fundamentalism not as this one big monolithic movement, but as two great strands. And one is what I call the popular front of fundamentalism. That's the televangelists that we're all familiar with, the pulpit pounders and the Bible thumpers. On the other hand, there's this elite strand that goes back to the 1930s that is made up mainly of upper-class folks. It's sophisticated, it's educated, it's internationalist. It's everything that we don't think of when we think of fundamentalism, and yet many of the theological convictions, the core beliefs, are the same.
Jeff Charlotte is contributing editor for Harper's and Rolling Stone. He's also an associate research scholar at New York University's Center for Religion and Media. His new book is titled The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. when they began the prayer breakfast in 1953, President Eisenhower had a negative reaction.
Yeah, the founder of the group, a man named Abraham Verady, had been trying to create this national prayer breakfast for many years. He thought of this as an event that would consecrate the nation to his vision of Christ. There was nothing ecumenical about it. And you go back and you look at his documents, it's a very specific idea of creating this image of obedience to his vision of Christ. FDR wouldn't do it. Truman wouldn't touch it. And Eisenhower didn't want to do it either. Saw it as a violation of church and state, but because Eisenhower was really one of the first presidents for whom an evangelical vote had been organized, both by Billy Graham, but also by a man named Senator Frank Carlson, he felt he had a debt. He agreed to do it. He says, look, I'll do it if there's no media. There was no media at the first breakfast, but it became what the founder of Verady knew it would, which was an annual ritual of civil religion that serves as a recruiting tool for their more fundamentalist vision.
When you say their more fundamentalist vision, are you implying sinister motives? What are their goals as the family?
I don't know if I'd use the word sinister. I would definitely use the word anti-democratic, though. And if you think that's sinister, and I don't think it's good, then it counts. You go back to the beginning of the group. It began with what the founder thought was a new divine revelation. He thought Christianity had gotten it wrong for 2,000 years by concentrating on the poor, the weak, the suffering, the down and out. He thought that God came to him one night in April 1935 and said, you know who I really care about? It's not the poor, it's the powerful. The up and out, the founder would call them, the key men. And if you can minister to those people, then they'll distribute the blessings to the rest of us, creating this idea of a trickle-down fundamentalism that was very much opposed to democracy. He was very explicit. He thought this in the 1930s. He thought democracy had run its course. He thought democracy couldn't compete with fascism or communism. He said, what is coming is the age of minority control, and this religion will be its creed.
What were the specific political goals of the group?
Well, the group really began as an anti-New Deal coalition in the Northwest and Seattle. They were very concerned about the power of organized labor, which was very strong, of course, under FDR. And the founder saw a lot of union leaders, in particular a man named Harry Bridges, one of the greats of American labor, essentially as satanic. And he thought that what they needed to do was bring together businessmen and politicians and so on, and together they could elect these God-led leaders who would break the spine of labor. And so that was their first project. Once that was achieved, and in Washington they picked a man named Arthur Langley, who became one of the longest-serving governors of the state, and governed, actually, I should say, as a pretty standard conservative after a failed attempt to pass a law that would allow him to annul any law he wanted. And after he gave up his supporters for a while, were doing a Sieg Heil salute, very literally, until there's minutes of a meeting where they decided that this was too fascist, and too was underlined, as if there was a just fascist enough kind of element. Once they had achieved that, they moved to this Washington from the West Coast to the East Coast and began organizing congressmen around this idea that they would come to call biblical capitalism, the idea that laissez-faire, unregulated capitalism is somehow ordained in the Bible. And that's really almost been their animating force for 70 years.
How often does the group come together?
Well, the way the group works, it's a network of friends, they'll say. And if suppose you are a congressman, comes to Washington, and Senator Sam Brownback sort of walked me through his experience with it. He first got involved with the family as a young college student. He comes to Washington to be an intern for Bob Dole and needs housing and is supplied housing by this group that says, here, why don't you learn more about this? And at the time, Brownback, one of the most conservative senators, was a fairly liberal Christian, but started moving rightward. Over the years, they were helpful to him in his career in Kansas. And when he came to Washington in 1994, he says, I went to Doug Coe, the leader, and says, I need a group of men to meet with and to keep me oriented religiously. And so Coe arranges a prayer cell for him that he would try to meet with weekly. So there's no great big convention. There's no, this is not the protocols of the elders of Christianity. This is a group of small cell-like organizations. And I use that word, even though it's got these terrorist connotations, Because the family uses the word cell and has actually since 1942, when they decided that there were too many obstacles to achieving things legislatively. If they could bring powerful men together in cells, they could reach agreements there around the person of Jesus, they said, and then go out in the world and implement them. But there's no centralized organization. There's nothing you can fight back against. This is just these congressmen pushing this agenda.
We talked yesterday with Ed Meese to invite him to come on. He declined. I gather he, too, is a member.
Yeah. Well, when I was living with the group for a while, Ed Meese was presiding over a weekly breakfast meeting of diplomats, mainly foreign diplomats, but also a few American businessmen who wanted to know these diplomats, maybe a few congressmen, that was held at their mansion in Arlington called the Cedars, a $4 million mansion. They bought with donations from the former CEO of Raytheon, various corporate executives who helped them fund this thing. And Meese would run this weekly meeting. He was still doing so in 2004 as well, when some other reporters looked into it. You know, the interesting thing about Meese is if you go and you talk to Meese, he'll say, oh, don't know anything about it. It's just a group of friends. If you go to the family's archives, and that's what makes the story possible, that they dumped 600 boxes of documents in Billy Graham Center archives in Wheaton, Illinois, you discover Meese's involvement going back to the 1980s. One of the interesting things is in the 1980s, he is corresponding with Doug Coe, the leader, and Gary Bauer, the popular Christian right leader, about privatizing welfare. And what you see there is the seeds of faith-based initiatives.
Jeff Charlotte, his new book is titled The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. Short break. Welcome back. I'm talking this morning with Jeff Charlotte. He's a contributing editor for Harper's Magazine, Rolling Stone. He's also an associate research scholar at New York University's Center for Religion and Media. He's written a new book, and he's gotten firsthand experience for taking on this subject. The book is titled The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. I do invite your questions, comments, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. I must say that the cover of the book you've chosen looks very much like that of a Bible.
You don't say. I think that may be a coincidence.
Right. You say that members are not representative of the majority of Christians, but of a movement called American fundamentalism. How do you define fundamentalism?
Well, fundamentalism, Christian fundamentalism, is traditionally defined by religious studies scholars as a separatist movement. And evangelicalism describes those who are more engaged with the world. But fundamentalism, an American fundamentalism, with that qualifier, I thought, was the best way to describe the totalizing vision that this group had. They conceive of United States as the heart of a worldwide sort of Christian empire, very literally. That's a term they've used in the past. And they want a government in which every decision is made with reference not to the people who voted, but as they often say to congressmen, you have only one constituent, and that's Jesus. There's only one person you're elected to serve, and that's Jesus. You know, that's they sort of forget that, no, you're elected to serve the people who elected you. So I decided that the word fundamentalism spoke to that kind of absolutism. There's a scholarly term that some scholars use called maximalism, which gives you a sense of this, but it's not as well known. And I think fundamentalism, going back to the beginning of the group when they did actually embrace the term fundamentalist.
But you mentioned Doug Coe, the head of the organization since 1969, who I gather has drawn his inspiration from some pretty controversial figures.
Yeah, well, this goes back to my experience living with the group. I moved in with them in Arlington thinking this was just going to be sort of an interesting... I mean, as the way I write about religion is I just go and experience what people are doing. And
what year?
This was in 2002. This is back in 2002 is when I first discovered the group. And almost daily, reference would be made to the leadership lessons we could learn from looking at great strong men of history, and the names that came up most often, almost like a trinity, were Hitler, Stalin, and Mao. And I was so shocked by this, and I wondered if this was, maybe some sort of outliers in the group. But as I went and I did the research, I discovered that this is really at the heart of their theology. I sat in on a session between Doug Coe and Congressman Todd Tehart of Kansas, in which Todd Tehart was going on about normal Christian right issues, and Doug Coe interrupted him to say, no, that's too small. We need a bigger vision, a stronger vision. He says, look at what Hitler was able to do. Look at what Lenin was able to do. And as I kept digging and digging, I found more and more of this. There's sermons you can find online where Doug Coe says you can best understand Christ's teachings by looking at Hitler, Lenin, Mao. He says, Hitler, Lenin, Mao, that's what they taught the kids, meaning the New Testament, Christ's teachings. Mao even had the kids killing their own mother and father, but it wasn't murder. It was for building the new nation, the new kingdom. This is his, he'll say that these are evil men. He doesn't endorse genocide. He'll say, I don't like their ends. I like their methods. Their methods, for most of us, are exactly the problem.
So how are their methods brought to bear on what's happening in this country from what you experienced?
Well, when I was first spending time with them, one of the things that alerted me to the idea that this was not the Christian right that I knew is that within the first week, we had a visit from Senator Jesse Helms. And that's not so surprising in the Christian right. But we also had a visit from the Prime Minister of Norway, not a usual figure on the Christian right speaking circuit. And that clued me in to the real internationalism of this organization and their outreach. And in fact, that Norwegian Prime Minister, part of a socially conservative government, ended up being subject to a major press investigation for his involvement with a family in Norway. The press took it much more seriously there. It was sort of like a Norwegian Watergate, and he was voted out of office. Norwegian said, this isn't transparent governance. We don't like this. But as I looked into it, you know, their reach into, you know, Norway, this is not setting off alarms. As I looked into it, I discovered that this rhetoric of admiration for strong men like Hitler and Stalin and Mao led to very real world consequences. And over the decades, some of their most important work has been playing matchmaker between the U.S. government and various foreign dictators. Some of the men who they were the first ones to vet and approve and start facilitating government U.S. government support for are such as Papadoc Duvalier of Haiti, Suharto of Indonesia, Siad Barre of Somalia. They admire these figures not because they're Christian. None of those men were. Maybe Papadoc sort of, but he also thought that he was God, so he's another category. But because of their strength, and they'll say, "Look, these men are chosen by God for their nation. So let's arrange for congressmen to meet them. Let's arrange for businessmen to meet them. Let's arrange deals." One story that came out of my own experience: there was a man who lived up the street named Dennis Baki, who's a very prominent energy executive. He was the longtime head of something called AES. It was pretty open about how he used a national prayer breakfast as a means for befriending the dictator of Uganda, current dictator named Museveni. And Museveni then awards a no-bid $500 million contract for a hydroelectric dam that no one in Uganda wanted. And you see that kind of relationship and you say, well, that's just blatant cronyism. But to the family, it's not. They're sincere in their belief that this is how God's working.
Do you believe that any of their activities, if out in the open, would be prosecutable?
There's an old law in the book going back to the beginning of the Republic called the Logan Act, which forbids diplomacy by private citizens, with good reason. One of the funny things is George Bush Sr. praising the family in 1992, praising Doug Coe from the podium at the National Prayer Breakfast, says, I want to praise Doug Coe for what I'd call, well, not quite secret diplomacy, but quiet diplomacy. And apparently Bush was unaware that if this is true, Coe is breaking the law because he's a private citizen.
What about the current George W. Bush?
The current George W. Bush has a slightly more interesting and ambivalent relationship to the family. When you go back and you look in his biography, I think those of us who are familiar with the president's religious life know that he really came to Christ through a group called Community Bible Study, which sounds very homey and local. But in the family's archives, you discover that the Community Bible Study was an effort organized in the late 70s, financed by the family, to reach out to businessmen who felt they were kind of too macho to go to church. They didn't like church. Church is for women and sissies and so on. And here was a Bible study for men. It was sort of a predecessor to Promise Keepers. Don Evans, former Secretary of Treasury, brought young George Bush in a Community Bible Study, and he ended up walking with Christ, as they say. But he never became a member of the family. And I think one of the things that we learn when we look at avant-garde fundamentalism is they want to know everybody. They're not purists. They're not doctrinally, concerned. So they have relationships with Democrats as well as Republicans. And in fact, they've been closer to some Democrats than to George Bush.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, there are many, many organizations in this country. Do you believe that this one is somehow set apart because of the prominent people who are members, because of the influences they are able to exert, or because of what it is they do?
I think certainly it's what they do. I mean, they're certainly not the most, there are other powerful organizations out there.
Of course.
Sometimes reporters ask me, they say, but isn't AIPAC just as powerful? And I say, yes, of course. When we look at the American Project and we ask ourselves, is this about a democracy or is this about an empire? And on the empire side of things, we have to realize that there are many moving parts, organizations that have this vision of American power that is much more imperial in nature, much less democratic. There are no puppet masters. There's no grand conspiracy. Like any social movement, there's forces coming from all different directions. But what that means is we've got a big job in front of us, and we've got to take apart this thing and look at each of these parts and understand what it is. So, no, the family is not the most powerful secret organization. They are, though, I would argue, over the decades, the most influential Christian right organization. And I'm lucky in having actually quantifiable data on this. A conservative sociologist named Michael Lindsay, who had tremendous access to the family because he's very sympathetic to him, surveyed 360 top evangelical politicians, including two former presidents, and discovered that more of them, one in three, more of them named the family as one of the most influential religious organizations in Washington than any other group. More than Focus on the Family, more than Family Research Council. That's astonishing, given that the group denies its very own existence, that one in three are saying this is really one of the power brokers.
But you were there. Were there moments when you were among people who are members of the family talked about, described, or made decisions that really upset you, that made you question what this group was all about?
When I was there, I was part of this house called Ivanwald, which is a sort of a training house for young men being groomed for leadership. So at that time, I didn't have access to the real power. Subsequently, I went and discovered this 600 boxes of documents. And so I had access to literally hundreds and thousands of papers of memos, meetings, budgets, everything. You know, they say there's no organization. There's, you know, probably more than a million documents with budgets for every year. You know, it's all right there. And that's when I was able to see the decision-making process. In person, I witnessed things that gave me terrible concern. For instance, I sat in a meeting with Ed Meese, and the ambassador of Rwanda was there at the time. And a couple of businessmen were talking about their recent meeting with the Dalai Lama. You know, I mean, that's a kind of a level of diplomacy was going on there. But what was really most disturbing is that when Ed Meese turned to the ambassador of Rwanda, and the family's been very involved in the Rwanda-Congo conflict, and talked about how any true peace must be made specifically on the basis of Jesus, and that we cannot negotiate unless we have Jesus at the table. And, you know, Rwanda and Congo, they need to get to peace any way they can. And the idea that we need to bring in this American version of Christianity to impose this on that country that has suffered so much is absolutely horrifying. And when you look at their history, that's what they've done and done again and again and again, applied their American version of Christianity to countries where it was absolutely inappropriate.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Is there any indication that members of the family were somehow active, involved, speaking out quite vocally in regard to Iraq and the invasion thereof?
One of the interesting things, when I was living with the family, we had a visit one day from David Coe, who's the son of Doug Coe, and at the time was sort of the heir apparent to the group, a man in his mid-40s, been counseling congressmen for years on their spiritual walk. And he came around to talk to us, and this is back in 2002 when I first discovered the group. And at the time, the United States had only gone to war with Afghanistan. And he points to a map on the wall, and he says, look at this. This is Afghanistan. He's trying to illustrate to us why Bush is not the great president that many of these men thought that he was. He's just another guy. They have a very long-term vision. He says, look at Afghanistan. Look how small that is. That's all that Bush conquered. He says, now let's think about Genghis Khan. And he points to the map, and he waves his hand across, you know, half the world that Genghis Khan conquered. He says, Genghis Khan conquered all this. He says, now imagine what we could conquer for Jesus. He says, when we know Jesus, and we really know Jesus, we will become a warning to the world. And this is a very peculiar idea of Christianity that I think would not be recognizable in any church in America. And I reported on popular fundamentalist churches. They still understand that they see a Christian message as that of love and mercy and forgiveness, not as a warning. This idea that Christ is a warning of a coming power. American power.
We've got lots of callers waiting. We'll open the phones now, 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Greensboro, North Carolina. Good morning, David. You're on the air.
Good morning. When I was a student in the mid-90s at the University of Virginia, my sociology professor, who incidentally was a religious sociologist, Jeffrey Haddon, invited a couple representatives from a group called The Family from D.C. down to talk to us. And I recall them being very young people, and there was like a musical element and a very sort of holistic spiritual kind of thing going on. But I don't know if that would have been the same group or a different group, or if they were just sort of the young version of what you're talking about.
It's possible. The Family is sort of one of these bland names. One of the curious things about the Family's embrace of the name as the sort of umbrella for the group is they chose it in the early 70s, right around the time when Charlie Manson was organizing his family and when another more traditional cult, also called the Family, was around there. That may have been, it sounds like you're sort of describing a musical thing that sounds a little bit hippie-ish. That might have been the traditional Jesus people family. But it could also have been young folks involved.
And to Wellington, Florida. Good morning, Rick. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Hi. It's funny your guest mentions the Logan Act because there's a group called the Bilderberg Group, which is similar to the Family, which sounds like it just minus the religious part. And high-ranking Bush officials have been, I guess, taped attending these closed-door meetings. But my question to your guest is, has he heard of the Bilderberg Group, and do they ever work together, you know, maybe with the Family? And I'll take my comment off the air.
Thanks.
Well, thanks for your question. I don't really look into the Bilderberg Group, and I think there's something in Northern California, a gathering that people are concerned about. I find that a lot of emphasis on those kinds of networks tend to be conspiratorial. And as a journalist and as a religious studies scholar, I think that the most important thing for us to do is to move away from any kind of conspiracy theories. There aren't really a lot of conspiracies out there. Rather, there's networks of activists. You know, I mentioned the Logan Act, but by and large, the family isn't breaking the law. They're making laws, but they're not breaking the law. They are pursuing, as they're entitled to do under the First Amendment, their religious beliefs.
What laws are they making?
Oh, one example I talk about in the book that I wouldn't say the family makes, but in the way they describe their cell, they say a cell should be an invisible believing group, out of which relationships and action grows. One such was the 1999 Silk Road Act.
We'll talk about the Silk Road Act when we come back. Jeff Charlotte, he's the author of The Family.
Support for NPR comes from Miriam Muscarolis and Grant Abramson, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. From the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And from AMARC Foundation, supporting procon.org, with the 2008 presidential candidates' positions on many issues at procon.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Photographer Brent Sturton's 2007 picture of a murdered mountain gorilla being carried out of Virunga National Park in the Congo sparked outrage around the world. He recently returned to the park for the National Geographic cover story, Who Murdered the Mountain Gorillas? Sturton joins us on the next Fresh Air.
And here are several emails for Jeff Charlotte on his new book titled The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. The first email goes this way. It says, your segment on The Family is just a semi-veiled attempt to demonize conservative Christianity and the Republican Party. You've already said that members of the family are both Democrats and Republicans, have you not?
I have indeed said that, and I'll go a little further and say that this inner circle of the family rejects the label Christian altogether. So if this is an attempt to demonize Republicans and conservative Christians, it's an absolute failure because the family is something different. And one of the things that I take heart from, and as I've been going around promoting the book, I've been doing a certain amount of Christian right radio. And a lot of ordinary Christian conservatives, very conservatives, people who embrace the term fundamentalist, are just as disturbed, horrified by this group as I am. In fact, they're sometimes more disturbed because they see this as misrepresenting the gospel. They read their New Testament and they don't see anything about Hitler, Stalin, and Mao. And they say, what is this guy Doug Coe talking about? Why is he helping Suharto, who killed 500,000 of his own citizens? And so I have great hope that conservative Christians will be one of the forces that can become present a really democratic, small d democratic challenge to this kind of authoritarian religion.
Here's an email that says there's an article on Wikipedia that mentions that the family owns a townhouse at 133 C Street in Washington, and that representatives Zach Womp, Bart Stupak, Jim DeMint, Mike Doyle, and Senators Ensign and Sam Brownback live there. Is that over behind the Library of Congress Madison Building? What can you say about this arrangement? I read that they pay $600 in rent per month.
Yeah, when I was living with a family, I had a few occasions to visit the C Street House, as it's called. It's a former convent. It's registered as a church, so it doesn't pay taxes, although none of the congressmen who were there at the time knew that. They're given below market housing. Most of those men who are mentioned were there several years ago when the Associated Press wrote about it, actually. I don't think most of them are there now. I met Senator John Ensign there. I sat in on a session with Representative Todd Tehart there. And I looked around this place, and it's sort of a startling place because here's very mainstream congressmen. And then, for instance, they have a calendar on the wall that gives them a prayer topic for each day. This seems very reasonable until you look closely at the prayer topics. Many of them are that we pray to bring down demonic strongholds. This language is already a little unusual. What do they mean, demonic strongholds? One day that I was there, the demonic stronghold, a stronghold that they were to be praying against was Buddhism. Another day it was Hinduism. So that's when, you know, when I describe this as fundamentalist, I'm not using the term lightly. They are not part of, you know, that recent Pew survey that was just in the news yesterday that finds that although many Americans are deeply religious, they recognize and respect other faiths. The family is not part of that tolerant branch of American life.
Here's an email from David in Baltimore. Is your guest fearful for his safety as a result of this work? There's a story that you tell.
Yeah, in Chapter 9 of the book, I describe some of the responses I received to the first time I wrote about this in Harper's Magazine, and various folks would get in touch with me. One was sort of the strangest was a woman who wrote saying that she was a fan of mine and she would like to meet and learn all about writing and could I have time for a cup of coffee. I met with her. In walks in this knockout blonde and she's flattering. And I said, this is incredible. This is not what usually happens in journalism. But as time went on, we talked for a long, long time. She gradually says, well, look, I'm going to come clean with you. I'm here from the Coes, the leader of the group. Doug Coe is like a father to me. You betrayed him. And I've been sent here to learn your heart. And it was just such a strange, strange response, but emblematic of so many of the responses that I got from them. I went to them under my own name. They knew who I was. They knew what I did. Over the years, so many of them have gotten in touch with me saying, oh, I'm just interested in your work. One day I got a call from an oil executive in Angola, as one does from time to time, said he was just interested in my work. As time goes on, he says, in fact, that he'd been very involved in the family and he wanted to talk to me about it. I'm not fearful for
saying
my life.
What? What did this man from Angola want to say to you?
Well, one of the things he wanted to explain to me was why there's a need for secrecy. And as I explain in the book, this guy's name is Greg Unum. He's was at the time an executive with Pride Former, a power company, energy company. He says, well, you know, don't misunderstand the secrecy. I mean, it's not because of some sinister plot. We have to be secretive because of the whole church-state separation thing. To which you're just wondering. I mean, there's almost a disconnect. They really believe in the goodness of what they're doing. And I think this is one of the interesting things that when you look at American fundamentalism, so many liberals out there and so many secular folks believe that these kinds of guys are very cynical, that it's all a veneer for making money. They do make money, but it's not cynical. They're very terribly sincere. And that's, in fact, I think, what makes them more dangerous to democracy.
And Katie sends an email saying, is this for real? It sounds like a Dan Brown novel. Aside from access to powerful people at breakfast meetings, how much and what kind of power does this group really have?
well, I should have the sales of a Dan Brown novel. But in fact, the book is a different kind of thing. There's extensive notes, an academic apparatus of notes. You can go to the archives and review these documents yourself. And you can decide how much power does this group have. You know, you look back in some of the historical examples. I mentioned Papa Doc, 1959, two senators, Senator Frank Carlson and Senator Homer Capehart, led a delegation of American businessmen. This was not an official trip to go and interview Papa Doc and decide, was he a man of God? They came back. They were both powerful senators involved with foreign affairs. And they said, yes, this is a man of God. They spoke to their fellows. They said, let's do what we can to help Papa Doc stay in power. In some ways, when you look at this, you say, well, oh, but what does this have to do with American life? It has to do with whether we here, as American citizens, are we citizens of a democracy or are we citizens of an empire that sustains itself on the suffering of others? And I think most of us, conservative Christians, liberals, we don't want the suffering of others. No one endorses what happened in Haiti or Indonesia or is happening now in the Central Asian republics where the family is very involved. These are not things that we want to be a part of, and yet the family brings our American tax dollars to bear on those.
Let's talk about the Silk Road Project.
A Silk Road Act passed in 1999, renewed in 2006. It's one example of what I look at as the legislation. There's no envelope stuffed with cash going on here. This is an ideological project. There's not voting blocks. This is shaping ideas. Family cells are described as invisible believing groups out of which relationships and then actions should occur. Well, the Silk Road Act was led in the Senate by a man named Senator Sam Brownback and the House by Representative Joe Pitts, both very, very involved inner circle family guys. And you look at the Silk Road Act and what does it do? Well, it's giving money to a lot of these Central Asian countries, new former Soviet republics, that are led by dictators. And when I spoke to Brownback about it, he says, well, we need to make sure that these countries remain open for American business, open for American missionaries, and we need to make sure that they don't become breeding grounds for radical Islam. Well, if there's anything we've learned in the last 10 years is that if you want to breed radical Islam, prop up a dictator who crushes his own people. That's what's happening there. At the same time, that Silk Road Act is a great boon to corporations that are dealing with natural gas, pipelines, and so on. Corporations or companies such as Koch Industries, which happens to be Brownback's chief financial backer. Again, it's a tautological loop of power that they see as proof of God's judgment on them. They are wealthy because they are part of what they call the new chosen. They think the Jews broke their covenant with God and are no longer the chosen people, and they're the new chosen. And here's the proof. You send money to the Central Asian republics, and you get money back into your campaign coffers.
So there are no Jewish members of the family.
Well, ironically, I am a Jewish member of the family. When I joined, there's a sort of a dumbed down Calvinism to the group. They believe in an elect. You know, once you are chosen by God, you're chosen for good. So I became a member. It means I'm still a member. I'm a bad brother now, but I'm still a brother. And I'm Jewish. And that was actually one of the things that made them interested in me. One of the ways in which they differ from the popular Christian right, and which I think a lot of Christian conservatives would find very disturbing about them, is they don't insist that you give up your religion, if you're a Muslim or a Jew, because they say your religion has nothing to do with the true power of Jesus. So Suharto, who's a Muslim, was a Muslim, they said, was a Muslim follower of Jesus. A Jew who is involved is a Jewish follower of Jesus. I remember speaking to Representative Eric Cantor, a rising star Republican from Virginia who's Jewish, about his involvement with it. He's not a member, but he's prayed with them. And I said, don't you feel a little uncomfortable as a Jew, as a very observant Jew, praying to Jesus? And he says, oh, you know, well, it's just different names for the same God. Well, that sounds very nice and ecumenical, but no, that's really not what Judaism is. Jesus is not a God for the Jews.
Let's go now to Indianapolis. Pierre is on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning, Diane. Can you hear me?
Certainly can, sir. Go right ahead.
Yes. My question was, and I wanted to listen to the comment because I'm in a place where I don't have a radio. Real quickly, how many publishers of newspapers and editors or writers belong to this group? Because I can't imagine that they're not a part of this group. And I've seen a lot of things in Indianapolis with this media group out here that really scare me.
That's an interesting question. When the family began, they were very intent on recruiting media figures. One of the, in fact, the guys who was very involved in the early days was David Lawrence, the original publisher of what became U.S. News and World Report. Lawrence, in fact, was Jewish, but he loved the fierce anti-communism of the group, and so he got involved. But over the years, they've moved away from media figures. I think they're still around the country, especially in smaller papers, as men who are involved in their sort of local organization of the family. But at the top level, not so much. And that becomes relevant because people say, why doesn't the media do more of this? Are they members? Is there a conspiracy? There's something much worse than a conspiracy. It's called conventional wisdom. And that, I think, is what prevents the media from seeing this fundamentalism that doesn't look like the fundamentalism they've grown accustomed to in the form of televangelists and so on.
And to Denton, Texas. Good morning, Joel. You're on the air.
Good morning. I have just finished reading American Fascists by Chris Hedges, and there seem to be a lot of parallels between the current evangelical movement, such as Jesus Wants You to Be Rich, and the people, the family that your guest is talking about. I was wondering if, I've heard him mention a lot of the differences, but there seem to be some startling similarities. And last question, is there somehow an ambivalence towards these movements because they are behind this moniker of Jesus?
Those are great questions. I have a lot of respect for Chris's work, but I disagree with him a little bit on what I call the F word, which is fascism. And it's not always such a useful word in American life. And I think you look at the family, and the family, more than any other Christian right organization, has real connections to real fascists going back in the 1930s. When some of the leading American fascists, a guy named Merwin Hart, was involved. And after World War II, when, with a mandate from the State Department, they went to Germany and started recruiting former Nazis of the dependable type, went the letter from the State Department, who would basically switch out their allegiance to Hitler for Jesus and become useful in the West German government. One such was Hermann Abbs, who was long presided over the Deutsche Bank until the 1970s, when the Simon Wiesenthal Center discovered that before he had become West Germany's banker, as he was known, he had been known as Hitler's banker. And he became ahead of the family's German operation. So they had real fascist connections, and yet they never became fascist. And this is relevant, because when you look in their early documents, they're wondering. They're very much drawn to fascism. But they identify a couple things wrong with fascism. One, fascism puts a worldly person in the spot where they think Jesus should be. They have the same kind of cult of personality, but they use it for their concept of Jesus. And two, they don't have the open and explicit reverence for violence. Now, much violence comes from their actions. In Somalia, for instance, they helped facilitate the doubling of the defense budget for a dictator who used it on his own people. But they don't talk about violence, and I think that's where we need to make a distinction.
At 5 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And finally, to Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning, Kevin. You're on the air.
Thanks. A quick comment and a question. It kind of goes what Katie said in her email. This is almost unbelievable. You've got the inner workings of the government infiltrated by people who hold Jesus up as an example, along with Hitler, Stalin, and Mao, and they are an integral part of our government. My question for the author is, do they want to do this violently, or do they want to do this through prayer? I'll feel a lot better if the answer is the latter. Thank you very much.
It's not so much what they want to do. It's what they've done. They've been doing this for a long time. And yes, they do this through prayer, but they also do it through what are backroom dealings. I'll close with this story. Chuck Colson, the Watergate felon, when he was converted by the family, as he describes in his book. And back in the 1970s, after he's out of office, at a press conference, Dan Rather says, "Hey, look, we've noticed Chuck Colson's going to the White House every week. What's he doing around? He's not supposed to be there anymore." And Nixon's press secretary says, "Oh, he's just coming for a prayer meeting." And Rather, much to his credit, says, "Oh, give me a break. We all know what goes on at those prayer meetings." And indeed, when you go and you look at Colson's archives, which are also at the Billy Graham Center, he writes it plain as day. He says, "I discovered I was able to accomplish through religion what I was never able to accomplish through electoral politics."
What about women? Are there any women at the top of this group.
In many senses, they're a traditional fundamentalist organization. They believe in something called male headship. Women's roles are to be submissive. But if you're a powerful woman, then they're interested because their bottom line is power. If you're a powerful woman, they'll treat you like a man. But they're more interested in getting men into power because they think that's God's plan.
Jeff Charlotte, his new book is titled The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. Fascinating book, Jeff. Congratulations.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from Softscribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.